Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And we are recording this as the Mets are tied 4-4 on September 16th against the Phillies. Jacob deGrom left the game with an injury. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. But first, it appears like the Mets have a new owner. There has been an agreement put together between Steve Cohen and the Wilpons to sell the team. All that is waiting to happen now is the approval of the other owners. That will happen in November. So theoretically, by the time the winter meetings start, the Mets could have a new owner. We've talked about Cohen a little bit in the past, but now this is getting real. And I am very interested to see how fans deal with Cohen. Because on one hand, and I don't want to totally besmirch our new owner right before he even shows up. But, I mean, he seems like a pretty immoral dude when it comes to money. You know, like he's been investigated for lots of you know, bad shit when it comes to his personal financial situation as well as his company's financial situation. And, you know, I don't think that there can't be a good billionaire, but it's probably very hard to be a good billionaire. And so, you know, I would not be super stoked to find out that Steve Cohen was my new boss. Let's put it that way. But he's not the Wilpons, and we all know how the Wilpons have been for, well, forever. And so I'm curious to see how much rope this guy is given before fans turn on him, or if fans have already turned on him. You know, I also think that this is just an interesting political time to be buying a baseball team, because it's during an election year. He's given a ton of money to Trump, and you know, this just feels very weird for a lot of reasons. What are your overall thoughts on new Mets owner Steve Cohen?
Well, he's not the Wilpons.
Yep.
That is really the biggest thing. So I was thinking about it because we've talked about a couple of things with Cohen on previous episodes. And it's funny, he's been a character in the Mets universe now for like almost a year.
Yeah.
But we've talked about, as you said, what's the honeymoon period, and you know, that kind of thing, and we've talked a little bit about just, you know, what the team might look like, how it could be run under him, and yeah, I mean, I think you summed that up pretty nicely. I wouldn't want to. I don't know. I don't want to assume anything, really. But we know the Wilpons have mastered the art of dysfunction. We know they're meddlesome. And this, it's really a situation where somebody who's coming in who, even if it was just the Wilpons' personality traits, you know, which, and to be fair, it's really Jeff Wilpon's personality traits that seem to get most of the negative attention. You know, going back years, we've heard stories like the Mets AAA affiliate isn't in Norfolk anymore, and that this is going back a long time now. But it's not down there anymore because Jeff Wilpon fucked something up by being himself in dealing with that franchise that had been a Mets minor league affiliate for quite some time and was a reason that David Wright was a Mets fan when he was growing up, you know?
Yep.
So I can't really talk about Cohen without framing him as not a Wilpon, but
I mean, just the thing I was trying to explain to my wife, who's a Mets fan, but a very casual Mets fan. I was trying to explain to her why the Wilpons are so bad. And she was getting it, but I said, just let's look at it this way, okay? So the Wilpons, Fred Wilpon's brother-in-law is a guy named Saul Katz. They own the team together. Saul Katz's kids hate Jeff Wilpon so much, they refuse to inherit a multi-billion dollar organization to work with him. And she was like, yeah, okay, I get it now. Like, what else can you say? He's their cousin. They hate their cousin so much that they wouldn't even run a multi-billion dollar corporation with him.
Yeah.
That's so, it. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. So I guess to focus on Cohen a little bit more from my perspective here, it would just be he's coming into it despite the track record and you know, the fines that he paid for financial indiscretions, crimes. I forget which thing it was, you know, what exactly how it breaks down. But he's coming into this as somebody who isn't an ownership group or a single owner who had been roped into the Madoff Ponzi scheme and then playing this balancing game of, you know, debt that the team had and trying to be competitive, but never doing a full rebuild, but also never really spending at the top of the free agent market. It just,
and never that, even really breaking down when they could have. They've mishandled almost every opportunity they've mishandled.
Right. And going back in time, I was never somebody, and I would not have, even in hindsight, traded David Wright. Jose Reyes, in his first long stint as a Met, I would have tried to keep him around, you know? But yeah. Cohen's not coming into this as somebody who's in a compromised financial position. So we don't know how he's going to behave as an owner. Day one, what he's going to do. Oh, I just remember the thing that we had talked about too. Whether or not he keeps Brody or other people in the front office around.
Yes.
And the more, like at some point over the last week, I was like, oh yeah, we talked about that on the podcast. And the more I think about it, I'm like, Brody's too close to Jeff. And we know Jeff has been like waging a campaign to get the A-Rod J-Lo ownership group to buy the team. And it's still leaked stuff related to that. They'll match the offer if the other owners just reject Cohen. All that stuff says to me that if there's any actual closeness between Brody Van Wagenen and Jeff Wilpon, that Cohen will make a change. But who knows? One of the things that feels like an ancient memory now was when Van Wagenen was ripping the commissioner.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, wait, nope. I was actually ripping Jeff Wilpon. So I don't know what that relationship is like, you know, as people who aren't there to see that on a daily basis, or seeing it, you know, remotely in the way that most of us who work in offices are working these days. I don't know what that relationship is like, but.
Well, I mean, you know, on one hand, we've heard that they are close, but I can't imagine when he was an agent that he was cozying up to ownership necessarily.
Right. Like maybe,
maybe a little bit, but I mean, we've seen how other agents are with ownership usually.
Right. And we've seen like a photo of Van Wagenen and one or more of the Wilpons playing golf. I don't know, you know, that doesn't necessarily indicate anything extreme to me.
Right.
I'm sure plenty of people have played golf with somebody that they actually don't like, but yeah, it's if Brody Van Wagenen wants to stick around in the front office, either as general manager or in some other role, then I'd imagine his next month is going to be about demonstrating to Cohen that he is completely independent of Jeff Wilpon and will not entertain anything from him, as the Wilpon family, the Wilpon and Katz family holds on to a very small 5% stake in the team. And I say very small, and it's still worth more than I'll ever make in my life, but
same. Yeah. Well, here's my question about the stake. Does this mean that the minority owners are also selling their shares to Cohen?
So I don't think I've seen anybody explicitly say that, but it's been reported as 95% Cohen, 5% Wilpon, Katz, you know, Sterling Metz, whatever.
I wasn't sure if that meant the Wilpons were selling him 95% of their stake.
Well, yeah, and I think so. Two things. One, I don't know exactly how it worked in terms of those people who had invested money in the team, in terms of whether or not they had a specific percentage of the team. Mm-hmm. But I have, through a friend of a friend, is married into one of those families.
Ooh.
So I've met one of them like once or twice at a game, and my understanding is that he's out, and I would assume that means everybody who did that same kind of thing is also out.
Agreed. Yeah.
You know, so that there's no expectation of continued, and really like the people who put that money in were treated as like ultra season ticket holders.
Right. Yeah.
With some access to the Wilpons and all that, but it's not like they were, you know, given free rein to just go into the clubhouse and, you know, like show up at work or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like they were, I think they were treated, just based on my knowledge of what this one guy had, you know, they were treated nicely and well, and had a level of access that the average person does not, but were not anything really more than that. And I remember the time that happened, whether it was Howard Megdahl or somebody else, but Howard really has been like the preeminent Wilpon reporter in, you know, the entire span of their ownership. But I remember as that was going down, a lot of however many people put that 20 million in, I think it was each.
Was 20 million each?
I thought so. Maybe.
I'm not certain. I was just curious. I remember the only person I know, and I don't know this person, I'm not as known from TV, is that Bill Maher was one of the people.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is my long-winded way of saying that I think it got you something. So I'm sure that being, I'm sure that 95% of the team being bought out means that you're getting some money now.
Right.
I just don't know exactly how it worked in terms of whether or not you were technically loaning the Mets money and making money back on that, or if you actually had like a 0.5% stake in the team. And then you would get 0.5% of the amount that Cohen is paying. I don't know specifically on that front, but what I think would be absolutely perfect would be if the 5% group that remains is like, here you go. You got a suite. It's not the owner's suite, but you can come to games and watch and whatever. And that's it. That's what you do now. You know, the same people in the stadium who, I'm sure were happy to give way when Jeff Wilpon was walking through and all that might be charged with telling him like, nope, you can't go here anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that for a 5% stake, you pretty much get to walk anywhere that isn't restricted to team personnel. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go through every VIP area, every box, every exclusive dining area, probably eat for free, whatever it is, but he's not, I don't think Jeffy can get back into the clubhouse anymore.
Right. And man, I am looking forward to the stories. We've already heard some of them, you know, Pedro Martinez with his story about Jeff Wilpon specifically wanting him to pitch in a game where he was not feeling 100%. And it was specifically brought up, like the Mets were out of it and the gate was brought up in terms of the matchup and who they were playing. And, oh man, it'd be great to get you out there and we get people out here to the park and whatever, whatever. You know, just that kind of thing where you can't treat players like that.
Well, you know that, Chris. And I know that. I don't think that Jeff Wilpon ever learned that.
Yeah. Oh, one thing that's just randomly coming to mind. And I think, I don't think it's any secret that the Mets in their Wilpon form were not always the biggest fans of Zach Wheeler. And in isolation, I wouldn't have exactly given him the contract the Phillies did myself. But that's for, you know, it's for different reasons, but through a friend who isn't the friend of the friend, but through another friend who had a relationship with the Wilpons over the years, you would always hear how frustrated they were with Wheeler. You know, when he was hurting, they didn't believe that he actually was hurting. They thought he didn't want to play. He didn't want to pitch, you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, if you're watching Zach Wheeler on the Phillies and wondering why he's there, I know Brody Van Wagenen had the dig publicly about a couple of half seasons that were really good, but that's kind of the job of the GM is to go out and be the face of an organization and maybe take that heat on behalf of ownership if something backfires. But I have no doubt in my mind that the reason that Wheeler isn't still a Met is that the Wilpons had already gotten sick of him years beforehand.
Yeah.
And were just happy to see him go. And, you know, it's funny. This is my last Wilpon thought, unless you want me to say any more. But I think back to the 2015 World Series, and one of my favorite moments as a Mets fan, and I think I've talked about it on the show before. I know I've talked about it at ARGs and everything. But it's the World Series, and there's a Met fan behind me who's about my age, maybe like a year or two younger, and just hating on every single Mets player who gets into the game. And I just turn and I'm like, do you like anybody on this team? Like, why are you here? You know?
Yeah.
And you encounter that, and I'm sure every fan base does, but it's just sort of perfect that the people who are in charge of this team, obviously the infamous Fred Wilpon interview about David Wright and company, and knowing that they can never just fully appreciate the good players they have, whether it's Wright or Beltran or Wheeler or anybody else, that they can never really fully get on board with their good players and always see the downside. It makes sense that a team that was run that way and threw players under the bus after they left almost universally, it makes sense that a segment of their fans also hate everybody on their team.
Yep.
So that's all. I still didn't really give too much of an answer on Cohen, but
no, but I think that for everybody, I think most fans of teams hate their owners, or at least don't love their owners, have issues with ownership. And obviously the Mets are, you know, the Wilpons have owned the Mets for long enough and have owned the Mets through enough good times that were that never became great times because of them and how they ran the team. And there's a lot of legitimate beef there. I also think that they are just buffoonish and so therefore very easy to laugh at. I don't know if I've told this story on the pod before. I know I told you. I know I've mentioned it to other Amazing Avenue folks. When we were in Port St. Lucie this year, the day before you got there, I found myself in an elevator with Fred Wilpon. And it was like me and Fred and then probably 15 of Fred's, maybe 15 is very high, 7 of Fred's pals. So it was the elevator that brings you from the press box down to like the media room. And so I was on the one level. I guess they were on the top level. I was coming on the middle level, and we were all going to the bottom level. So I get in the elevator, and it's crowded people. And someone goes, oh, come on in, there's room. So I step in, and everyone is standing, except to my left, Fred Wilpon is sitting on the tallest stool I've ever seen. So he was like towering over the rest of the people. It's like what Mr. Burns would have done in The Simpsons. It was just like this hilarious reminder of, oh, you're beneath me, literally. And and I feel like there are so many Wilpon stories that involve one or both Wilpons just being totally out of their gourd with whether it's, you know, just thinking of themselves as being better than they are, or you know, talking like they know what they're talking about. I mean, Jeff Wilpon speaks as if he's Cy fucking Young, you know, and he doesn't know much about baseball from what I can tell. Even though he's been around baseball his entire life, I don't think the guy has too much of a clue about baseball. You know, they're just buffoons. They're the Bluth family. They're the Bluth family from Rest Development. And, you know, they're buffoons. And so I don't see how you can't look at them and just laugh. And so to be able to have ownership that doesn't make you just want to laugh is a really nice thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's look, we just don't know what Cohen would do, but it really feels like a situation where it can't be worse is applicable.
Yeah, I mean, I think on one hand, if he's going to be a shrewd businessman and run things kind of like, you know, I'm trying to think of other teams, you know, a team like the Rays, who compete every year but don't spend any money, but they compete every year because they're very smart about how they do things. If he wants to run the team that way, that makes more sense than how the Wilpons run it. If he wants to spend like a Steinbrenner, that makes more sense than how the Wilpons run it. The Wilpons just ran this team like an in-between franchise. They never ran it like a big market team, but they never ran it like a small market team either.
Right.
And I'm hoping that he would just be able to do something that would make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, and I think as fans, we have reason to be optimistic that he will want to win and do so quickly, because he's been a Mets fan his whole life. You know, if you told me that I was going to have enough money to buy the Mets tomorrow, I would be doing my damnedest to supplement this roster with the you know, the obvious things it needs. The Mets have a lot of good position players, young hitters, some defensive mismatches in terms of where some of these guys play, but they've got some very talented players and the best pitcher in baseball. There are way worse ways to start, you know?
Oh yeah.
So
I think it's going to be, I would be shocked if he winds up, if he winds up not spending some money.
Right.
And the Mets have taken the lead on an RBI single from Andrés Giménez.
Yeah. Man, he's been fun.
Yeah, he has been. And if I recall, there were two very handsome gentlemen in Port St. Lucie who thought he looked great earlier this year.
That is, yes. Yeah. Even in spring training games over a very short span of time, it was just, I don't want to put this expectation on him. Not on him, not that he's listening to our podcast, but for people who are, I don't want to set the bar at this. But he just got my attention in spring training this year the way that Syndergaard did a month or two before he got called up. My dad still takes the cake because DeGrom, like, he was so thrilled about how DeGrom looked. And, you know, that was in the spring training of the year he came up. And it was just, nobody was that high on him. You know, he started getting some attention, I think, and like he was on the radar, but nobody was that high on him, even coming out of spring training.
Right.
So that's still a much better scoop than either one of the two. But I can say, having gone down there, what, 7 or 8 times now, there's only been a handful of guys who have lit it up in a way that stood out to me in spring training. And Giménez was one of them. So seeing him do this at the major league level is it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's also very different. Like, we were not watching him take batting practice where so many people can look like monsters. We were just watching him in-game. The way he was making adjustments was just super, super impressive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, the way he – oh, my goodness. Can Jeff McNeil not run the bases anymore?
I'm not watching. What just happened?
He got thrown out on the bases again. Granted, he wasn't the one who got hung up, but he got tagged out between third and home. Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to do? There was a rundown between first and second, and then, you know, he was caught between third and home. I guess it wasn't really his fault. It's just.
But the answer is no, he cannot run the bases.
But hold on. I'm not trying to embarrass any current or former prospect guys on our site, but I just want to look back at you know, where DeGrom was in that, you know, going into that spring training.
Yeah.
15th.
Yeah, sorry guys.
Top five were, oh my goodness. And this is just the nature of how the game works. So, you know, not really trying to say anything more, but just DeGrom was not on the radar. We all know that. But the top five were Syndergaard, Darnot, Rafael Montero, Cesar Puello.
Oh boy.
And Wilmer Flores, and followed by Dom Smith and Brandon Nimmo.
Okay. I mean, overall, that's not a terrible list.
No. And then Plawecki, Dilson Herrera, Mats, Rosario, Yanoa, Chiquini, Fulmer, DeGrom. And right behind DeGrom, Domingo Tapia, who just pitched in the majors the other day for, I think, maybe the first time.
Was it the first time?
Let's see.
If it wasn't, it was one of the first times.
Yeah. I feel like... Yeah, he has one game in his Major League Baseball reference page.
Wow, okay, there we go.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
But let's talk about DeGrom for a second. So DeGrom left tonight with hamstring spasms. I was telling Chris beforehand, I was braving the supermarket when this was happening, so I did not see this. But, you know, we don't know how serious this is. It does not appear that it's necessarily a hugely serious situation. But again, we don't really know that. I have very mixed feelings on this. Because on one hand, if the Mets are going to be out of it, the one thing that I was sort of watching to root for was DeGrom maybe, you know, making a run at a third Cy Young. Now, if he's going to be hurt and not, that's not going to happen, that's a bummer. But I also don't want to see DeGrom pitching hurt. This season doesn't really matter to me. I think we've talked about this a lot on the show, how, you know, we should be grateful for every minute of baseball we get, but we also can't take the results of the season, good or bad, all that seriously. So if DeGrom's sitting out the rest of the year, that's not the end of the world to me. But if DeGrom is out, I think that the Mets are pretty much, there's almost no way they can make the playoffs now. It's already a long shot for them to make the playoffs, but it's an especially long shot if they don't have DeGrom. Do you feel the same way?
Oh yeah. I think I agree with all that. I want DeGrom to win another Cy Young just because that would be cool. But it's one of those things that if things go well, I'm all in. Even though I would still have that perspective that this was a very unique, short, strange season. But if the Mets won the World Series, then I would probably try to treat it as seriously as any other World Series.
Right.
And if they don't, which right now it looks like they will not, I would focus more on that context of the short, weird season. You know, it's not the end of the world. It's not the same. And absolutely don't want to see DeGrom pitching if he's not feeling 100%. Hamstring spasm was a weird description of an injury. I mean, even the booth, Gary, Keith, and Ron were like, okay, isn't that just like hamstring tightness or, you know, or right, pull? Right. Like, but yeah. What DeGrom does for you over the course of the next several years is much more important than potentially getting a Cy Young out of this season. And I also love that like his ERA right now is 2.09. And that's a disappointment.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
We're talking about it in Slack during this game, and I went back and looked, and obviously, again, you can't treat 2 months like a full season, but a 2.09 ERA, Pedro Martinez only did better than that three times, and all three were over the course of, you know, 162 game seasons. But it just puts it in some perspective that the nature of this year has allowed for, I mean, Trevor Bauer and Yu Darvish have been really good. You can't take that away from them. But it's allowed for 2 months of dominance to put you in the Cy Young conversation when DeGrom is continuing what he did over the last 2 years.
Right.
And you know, Darvish and Bauer each have some really good seasons on their track record, but neither one of them came into this season coming off 2 years like DeGrom did. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope he's 100% healthy and pitches a couple shutouts and wins another Cy Young. But I would much rather that he win the Cy Young next year when I am pretty certain there will be a 162-game season, whether fans are involved or not.
Right. Yeah, I agree with all of that. I want DeGrom to win every Cy Young until now, from now to the end of time. Right? I want him to win a posthumous Cy Young somehow because he's such a good pitcher. But ultimately, I think that no matter what, this season's going to have an asterisk next to it, just because that's the way it's going to be. And so if there's ever a season for him to not win the Cy Young, this is the season. And, you know, we really do have to be thankful for all the baseball we've gotten this season. We've talked about this before, how every game seems like an impossibility that it's even happened, especially given the way things were looking right before the season started. I mean, I think you and I, my brother and I had a bet where I think I owe him a steak dinner or other way around because we thought like the season was going to be over. I think I had within the first 14 days, he had within the first 10 days, something like that, because we just didn't think it was going to happen. And so the fact that we're getting this much baseball is a fine and good thing. The Mets have been relatively healthy. You know, they've done a good job with keeping the precautionary, you know, principles in place. And, you know, I think that this, we were talking about this in Slack last night. Some folks were saying, you know, well, if you're going to say that Dom Smith is for real, then you've got to say that Pete Alonso is not, right? And what I was saying last night was I think that 2 months of great play should buy guys more looks, buy guys the benefit of the doubt, buy them the opportunity to play more baseball. But I don't think that necessarily 2 months of bad performance should write anybody off. And I know that that's somewhat hypocritical to have different opinions about good and bad performances, but I think you understand what I'm saying. I think that it's easier to use this as a spring training, right? Nobody typically looks at the superstar in spring training who is hitting .125 and say like, oh, this, you know, they're done. Spring training is the time when people are working things out. It's such a small sample size, you know, you just don't know. And I think we have to kind of treat this small season the same way. So I think that this season has been instructive for guys like Jimenez, like Dom Smith, to a lesser degree like JD Davis. I think it's just given us a good chance to watch these guys play more and to see what they're really capable of. And yeah, hopefully that makes the decision-making process for next season a little bit easier.
Yeah, and I think the quantity and quality of play, and I don't think the quality of play is quite what it would be in a normal season. A significant number of good players have opted out, understandably, over COVID concerns. But you're still dealing with a major league level of play. And a major league level of play where the starting lineup is out there every day for teams. And it's not spring training where it's a couple innings or, you know, two or three guys who you would see in a normal game. So I definitely think this can be informative. But like you said, it's people doing something new that catches your eye, as opposed to, Pete Alonso has one season to his name, but it was really damn good, you know? So I think it's
our Dave C pointed out last night that we would be at like May 20th right now if this was a regular season.
Right. And at May 20th of Granderson's, what year was that? 2016, 17, whatever year it was, that was his last year as a Met I should have this memorized by now. But whatever the hell the year was, that people were hating on Granderson at the end of April, and then he was just phenomenal, mm-hmm, for most of the rest of the year. and wound up sort of, you know, living up to his career norms by doing so. Just don't give up on Pete Alonso because of this. And it's okay to be excited about, you know, Jimenez. And I'll admit, I've probably been a little too harsh on Rosario myself during this because Jimenez looks good.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that there's a lot of, just possibility with Jimenez and Rosario. And I think to a lesser degree, Louis Guillorme has proven this season how good he is.
Yeah.
I think that the Mets have, I think the Mets could trade one of those guys very easily and not hurt their depth too much. And so maybe that's what gets them a starting pitching this year.
Right.
You know, not an ace, but, you know, a back end of the rotation guy. You know, you can do that relatively easily now. And I think that, you know, it's just too early to write off Pete Alonso. You don't have those seasons do happen, right? I mean, like paging Brady Anderson, those big power seasons do happen, but they don't happen very often. And he hasn't lost his power this year. He just hasn't gotten to a rhythm this year. And part of that is that he's never really DH'd before, and they're DH'ing him every day. And I understand why. I'm not criticizing that decision. I understand why they're doing that. And that very well may be his position going forward if the DH sticks around, you know. But I just think you have to give him – last season was such a wonderful season that you have to give him a chance to replicate it under normal circumstances. If he looks this bad on September 17th of 2021, then I think we can have a conversation about whether or not that one season was an aberration.
Right.
But right now, I'm not comfortable having that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other DeGrom or rest of the season thoughts?
Well, if they somehow manage to pull this off and win a bunch of games and get into these expanded playoffs, I will be all in. I'm not going to lie. I think anybody who says that they'd write it off and, you know, have principles about whatever, like, they're full of shit.
Yeah.
And they know they are. Like, if
fuck
if
it, man. Somehow... I am so all in if they make the playoffs.
Right. Now they won this game tonight while we were recording, and they're 22-27. Let's say they win 5 games in a row, which I would not bet money on, but let's say they do. And they go into the last 4 games in Washington and have a shot to make these playoffs. I know I'll be into it. And I know I'd be into it if they, you know, pulled it off and went into these series. But the sort of the upside of all this is that, you know, as you've mentioned a couple times, we've kept in perspective that we're fortunate to even be able to watch some new sports. And, you know, in that context, I'm just not going to be as let down if they don't pull it off this comeback.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be for them to make the playoffs would be miraculous. For them to make the playoffs and do anything when they're in there would be what's better than miraculous. I don't even know. But, you know, especially look at how good the Dodgers are. Oh, the Dodgers are starting to falter a little bit. But, you know, it just seems like the path to the pennant is an incredibly tough path.
Yeah.
And so if they could somehow even make you, even trick you into thinking that they could make it to the pennant, good Lord, how fun is that?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hopefully everybody is, everybody's healthy and they can make it fun. And even if they miss the playoffs by a game, as much as a bummer as that will be, if they're providing exciting baseball for the next few weeks, I'm very happy.
Yeah.
It's better than where I thought we'd be. which is nowhere right now. Anyway, any other Mets related thoughts?
No, no, not just a new owner and you know, the best pitcher in baseball. Hopefully not being hurt. Nothing really else other than that.
Yeah, I suppose we've talked about some big stuff so far. Do you have a music pick ready to go? If not, I do.
I do. I'm just making sure I get the name of the record right. So right. Theosis, who constantly mix up getting OCs into the band name.
Yes. How is it spelled this time?
What? Let me see how they're listing it on it. Now it's O-S-E-E-S. Capital O, capital S, E-E-S, one word. So, yeah, they mix it up a lot. It's been O-O-C-S, Theosis, just O-C's, whatever the case. But they, I'll admit, I have not listened to the actual record yet, but they had put it up on YouTube around the time that the pandemic had hit the United States and things started shutting down. They had put up a rehearsal of it. So I don't know if it comes out this week, but KEXP has like an exclusive stream of it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so OCs, as they're, you know, naming themselves for this record, Protein, P-R-O-T-E-A-N, Threat, or Protein Threat. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's a word I should have known how to pronounce.
I believe it is Protean, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, yeah. That now that I look at it like three times, I'm like, yeah, that is a different word. Tending or able to change frequently or easily. So it's a fucking joke about the band name, apparently.
What is it? Okay, I see.
Protean, tending mm-hmm. or able to change frequently or easily. Able to do many different things, versatile. So I respect it. I love it. So yeah, I haven't listened to the actual record in the studio recording version of it yet, but I have heard the record as they played it in their rehearsal, and I can recommend it based on that. So it's OC's Protein Threat, and it's either, I would assume it's out this Friday if they dropped it as a, you know, streaming thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So check it out. KEXP has it on their website right now. Looks like it's a YouTube embed too, so I think it's there as well. And then on Friday, you know, Spotify, etc. And I think they have a Bandcamp, although you never know. If not, I think they're on ATO Records. But you know, if you're looking
for those,
to get...
for those that don't know the OCs, how would you describe their sound?
So they've been around since like the mid to late 90s, even though they're not that old. And John Dwyer is like the main dude. And I think there's been a variety of people who have played over the years. How would I describe their sound? So it's funny. There was a song that I swore was in a Grand Theft Auto game, GTA 5, I think. And there is a Theosis song in that game. But for some reason, in my memory, I still want to, like, I wish I could go back and look at one of the radio stations in that game to check. But officially, it's a different Theosis song than the one that was stuck in my head from playing the game. So maybe I just heard it around the same time. But it's funny because the older records had sort of a different sound. And then, you know, over the last 7, 8, 9 years now, the records all sort of makes the early ones made sense together too, but these all feel like they connect in some way, even if they don't necessarily sound the same. So it's their song. They have a tendency to have longer songs. There's vocals, but they lean more instrumental, and it's just, like it's probably one of my favorite combinations anybody's ever had of intensity, but also really cool melodies worked into it. So it's high energy music with long songs, which is relatively rare. Yeah. You know, the band Frankie and the Witch Fingers that I recommended at some point on an episode, sort of channels the OCs and King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard in that sense. You know, these bands that can go out and play like a punk rock pace, or even like a metal pace, since, you know, a good amount of metal can be faster, and do that and combine it with sort of the concept of what a jam band would do, you know? So if you took, I don't know, this might be, I'm just pulling this one out of my ass, but if you took the Bad Brains and the Grateful Dead and you had music come out of that combination, I think that's somewhere around the OCs.
That's a pretty good description.
Thanks. I like it. I'll have to say that a couple more times and see how people react. Well, but you know, like the Dead have plenty of songs that are 6, 7, 8 minutes long or longer.
Or longer, yeah.
And I'm going to stick with it. I'll keep saying it until somebody tells me that's a bad one, but I'm glad that you gave me a good first reaction on it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good description. I don't know. I don't have a better description, so I can't say, I don't know if I agree with it or not, because I don't have a better description of that. But I think the people might hear that and take the wrong parts of the Dead and the Bad Brains for that. But I think if you know both those other bands and you know the OCs, you can see how it all connects.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. So my pick is by a band called Low Tom, LOTOM. And this is a side project of David Bazan, who was and is the main guy behind Pedro the Lion, was also done a bunch of solo albums, was in an electronic band called Headphones, was part of a band called Passengers. Passengers? That sounds wrong now. Maybe that wasn't the name of it. It probably wasn't. Anyway, but he's been sort of an indie rock lifer. You know, Page of the Lion's first record came out in, I think, 97 or so. And this is a record he made, the second record under the Low Tom name, which he's made with a couple of other guys who are similarly indie rock lifers. Two of the guys from Starflyer 59, one of the guys who's played in a bunch of Page of the Lion projects and has a solo career named T.W. Walsh. And each record, the first one and this one, are each only 8 songs long. They're all really direct songs. This record, they have described as being all about debt, like both financial and sort of personal debt. I hear it about isolation. There's a lot of songs about, like, kind of the desire to get the fuck out of here, whether it's, like, out of here being, like, a bad relationship or out of here being, like, society. The last song on the album is called In a Van, and the chorus is like, believe me, I would sell it all and live in a van. So it's just about kind of just like getting away from everything. But this album is a little bit more aggressive than the last one. The last one was all like first or second takes, not a lot of overdubs. This is much more overdub. It's very dark. And if you were curious about how dark it is, the first album cover has a ceramic dog wearing sunglasses on it. This album cover, the dog is on its side and blood is coming out of its head. So it's
all right.
Just from the cover image, you're like, oh shit, this is dark. But they just kickstarted a vinyl release of this and then released it digitally the day the Kickstarter ended. And it's probably not quite as catchy as the first one. There's still some really good melodies on it, but this is a much, much darker record. And I feel like a lot of my music picks during this pandemic have been very sunny records, because I've been trying to counterbalance the shitstorm that is our world with what I've been listening to. But this feels, even though this was finished a year ago, this was, mm-hmm. I think it was actually finished in last spring. So it's, you know, it's not like it's written about the pandemic, but it just feels very of the time, and it feels very urgent and very just prescient for what we're going through, even though it doesn't, it never mentions Trump by name. It never, you know, obviously it couldn't mention coronavirus by name or anything like that.
Right.
It just feels like a very symbolic record to what we're going through right now. And so it's kind of dark indie rock. I don't know how else I would describe it, but I do hope that people check it out, if only because I think that the lyrics are quite strong and pretty available to the emotions that people are feeling right now. Like, I think you could listen to this and it's very easy to connect how you feel with how these lyrics are. So yeah, that's my pick, Low Time. Both their albums are called Low Time. This one's been stylized as LP2. Just they said, like, for your digital library, so they don't have two records named Low Time.
All right.
But yeah, so that's my pick. So thank you all for listening. Are we going to try and do a show next week?
I think try. If the Mets win every game between now and then, then it'll be helpful.
Yeah, let's put it this way. If there is if the Mets are in playoff position next week, I think we should do a show.
Yeah, a week from tonight, if the Mets are, you know, wrapping up their series with the Rays, because they've got one more against the Phillies, three against the Braves, three against the Rays. If at the end of that series they are still in it going into the final weekend, we will do a show. And if not, we might just have to eulogize the 2020 Mets after.
Yes. Yeah. We'll see how that goes. That. Yeah. But I do want to say thank you all so much for listening to us and sticking with us this season. It's been a weird one. Hopefully we never have another one like this ever again. God help us, please. Thank you for sticking around. Thank you for checking out AmazingAvenue.com. We have lots of interesting stuff going up over the next few days. And all the time, really. We're always trying to be your one-stop shop for all Mets-related content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find this show wherever you get podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, soon coming to Amazon Podcasts, I believe. And on whatever platform you get this, please rate, review, and subscribe. That helps folks find out about us. Chris is on Twitter at Chris McShane. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. And until next time, and possibly for the last time in the 2020 season, let's go Mets.